The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Before we start today's podcast, I want to tell you about a new exciting program called Rewire You. It's Second City's take on professional development, using the skills of improvisation to navigate an ever-complex and challenging business world with greater authenticity and resilience. More importantly, we have partnered with the Chicago Booth School at the University of Chicago to infuse the program with cutting-edge research from the world of behavioral science. Rewire You is great for current and future leaders who want to get more from themselves and their teams. You can find out more at secondcity.com/rewireu. Classes begin soon. Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Dacher Keltner. Dacher is a full professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and director of the Berkeley Social Interaction Lab and faculty director of the Greater Good Science Center. He is the author of Born to Be Good, The Compassionate Instinct, and his latest book, The Power Paradox. He has written for New York Times Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, and The London Times, and he was a consultant on the Pixar smash hit Inside Out. Dacher, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you, Kelly.
Before we dig into the power paradox, which I loved, I want to ask you about your work on the film Inside Out. And in particular, I read an interview where you were asked about the lead character, Riley, and how her sadness was an important and defining trait for her age and her gender.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that really is the kind of the point of departure and the inspiration for the film, which is my friend Pete Docter, who's the director of Up and then Inside Out. You know, he was going through this period in his family where his daughter, Ellie, was hitting her early teen years, 12, 13 years old, mm-hmm. like Riley, the character in the film. And what we know from the science of adolescence is that young women, you know, early teens, 11, 12, 13 years old, you know, they go from being some of the happiest people on earth to really feeling sadness and anxiety. And parents of early teen girls are often knocked off their feet by this developmental change, right? Their girls are loving and kind, and they sit on their laps, and they joke at the dinner table. And then, you know, 12, 13 years old hits, and they get really sad. And so I think Inside Out is this unique meditation upon the value and importance of sadness in our life.
Yeah, I have a 14-year-old girl, and I was telling her that we were going to talk, and I brought this up, and she and we were talking about the difference between girls and boys, and I said, you know, she agreed. She was like, you know, sadness is a huge thing, and she goes, for the boys, it's different. And I go, what do you think it's for the boys? And she goes, anger. And I'm like, nailed it.
Oh, yeah.
That's it.
Well, you know, what we know about the adolescent years, Kelly, is that, you know, the hormones hit and your identity shifts and maybe the prefrontal cortex starts to diminish a bit. And, you know, it's a crazy time. And my condolences to you and good luck.
Thank you so much.
But, you know, boys start to act out like I did, and girls turn inward very often and just reflect on, I think, the loss of childhood, which is a deep loss.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is not a leap to go from that to the kinds of things that you discuss in The Power Paradox. And there's so much covered in that book. But I was really struck by a very simple concept that you come to. And you say, quote, our power is granted to us by others, which maybe doesn't make sense to people initially. But as you dig in, I mean, that's so true. How do you see it play out that our power is actually granted to us by others?
Well, I actually think that this is one of the fundamental dimensions to human social life, right? If you study, as I do, from an evolutionary perspective, the power hierarchical dynamics of, you know, chimpanzees and bonobos, they do a lot of grabbing of power just through brute force. But what happens in human social life is we become these small groups in our evolution in hunter-gatherer societies and then tribes. And what that means is because we have such dense relationships and networks that can constrain the actions of people in positions of power, power moves from something that you grab, which is more characteristic of other mammals, to something that's given to you depending on how you act, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's been funny, Kelly, you know, when I wrote The Power Paradox, it's kind of an optimistic view of power, and we've, of course, had a very complicated time.
Yes, I
know. I
see where you're going with this.
Yeah, but, you know, even when you look at politicians, right, in functioning democracies, it still holds, which is a president's power, a politician's power, a CEO's power depends on other people following their lead, respecting them. So that, I think, we see playing out in today's American politics.
Well, absolutely. And the real power paradox you talk about is that we rise in, I'm going to quote you, we rise in power and make a difference in the world due to what is best about human nature, but we fall from power due to what is worst.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, in most contexts, and there are, you know, dictators who violate this rule through the use of military force, but in most contexts, we gain power, and I think it's almost this intuitive tendency to give power to people who seem like they're going to advance the greater good, right? Who are going to advance a constituency or an organization or a family, right? Or a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And so we gain power, studies show, by giving resources to others, by mobilizing people, building strong social networks, by, you know, a lot of studies show we gain power by expressing gratitude and showing empathy. And I know it seems like a rosy picture, and we could deconstruct that when we think about Trump and American politics. But, you know, the problems begin once we feel powerful and we lose all those talents, you know, and we've done all these crazy studies showing once I have power, I empathize with people less. If I drive a really powerful car, I'm more likely to blaze through a pedestrian zone, almost killing a person we positioned at the edge of the pedestrian zone. Power does lead to its abuse.
Yeah, I don't want to beat the Trump dead horse on here, but, you know, during the campaign, he was talking a lot about giving things away. He was talking a lot about, giving a group of people a voice, which could be called a generous form of communication. He was also creating an other throughout, which is certainly a thing we know in our work. But, I mean, I think simply we talk about this in improvisation all the time, right, that the need to be others focused, and that as we develop as human beings, certainly in a business context, we lose that a lot because we're so focused on ourselves. And being other focused can sound very altruistic, but it can also be manipulated. And I think that's what you're talking about when this power thing turns.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I was blown away reading some of the histories of the great leaders, and one that really struck me that's on this theme of being other focused as the foundation of enduring power, where Thurlow Weed, who was a journalist during Abraham Lincoln's day, said the defining quality of Lincoln, and this is very relevant to where you are, was that he saw and heard every person that came to him, right? Mm-hmm. That he had this abiding commitment and genius for just getting into other people's minds. And I think that if there's one law-like tendency in how we gain power in most of the contexts that matter to us, and here we're even talking about where we began, Kelly, which is like keeping the respect of your teenagers when they really come at you,
right,
is empathizing, is being engaging in the other, is knowing what other people think.
Yeah, and there's been some recent attacks on empathy from other parts of the ivory tower. Paul Bloom's work, where he sort of goes after empathy, and I guess I have not read beyond a few articles on that because obviously in improvisation we're big on the empathy thing. But you know, even Kim Scott, who I interviewed, talks about ruinous empathy, which I get that as well, that we can allow our care for others to deprive us of acting in others' best interests. But that seems to me to be sort of a misuse of empathy.
Thank you for saying that, Kelly. So, you know, there are always counterexamples to rules, and scientists can, you know, get a lot of attention by pointing out interesting counterexamples to things that we really consider to be truisms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so empathy has its dark side, right? So the sort of the notion out there, for example, is that really manipulative Machiavellian sociopaths, maybe they are better at empathy and they use it to manipulate, as you suggested earlier, yeah. Although the data don't really line up with that. Hmm. The other place where empathy is problematic is when you're really dealing with a lot of suffering around you, where if you, in the purest sense of the term, mirror and take on the emotions of pain of other people, it's going to be harder to be an effective nurse or medical doctor or someone taking care of a sick relative. And you have to move up out of that empathy. But, you know, Kelly, you know, the work out of social intelligence of Mark Brackett at Yale, and I mean, just about everywhere you look, if you know what other people think, you're going to do better in life, and the people around you will do better too. So I think it's a little bit of a red herring, to be quite frank.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. I was actually, when I was reading your book, initially, my wife was in the other room, and she's a comedy professor, and we keep getting, you know, we're constantly being interviewed, right, by now news magazines to ask about the current situation in our government as it relates to satire and comedy, everything from Alec Baldwin's portrayal. And I thought it was really interesting the way you link understanding power as a way to understand the influence of things like satire, the written word, art, and music. And I think you say because they speak to our core human beliefs.
Yeah, you know, thanks for bringing that up. And I feel one of the underappreciated virtues of humans is our comedic, humorous, playful, satirical mind. And it really is one of our great geniuses. And you know, one of the things that I think has emerged in the science of power, and this really begins with Joseph Nye at Harvard, who's in the School of Government talking about soft power, right? Mm-hmm. And a country's soft power, we have hard power, which is the obvious stuff that we think about, like military might and economic sanctions and interventions and the like. Mm-hmm. But we also influence profoundly through culture, through art, through song, through fashion, through ideas about haircuts or comedy or the like. And Nye made this early provocative argument that in a way, is a country's greatest strength, is its culture. Hmm. And I agree. I think when you look at the last 40 to 50 years of the use of military might in the United States, it hasn't gone that well. Right. And you look at how we influence today, and it's through our culture. So you translate those ideas to our lives, right? Our lives and our family and community. And what it tells us is there is such massive influence in a novel, in a film. Alec Baldwin, you know, Saturday Night Live right now is making New York Times headlines, right? And it's satire, mm-hmm. As political commentary. So that tells us how important these other forms of power, soft power, you know, artistic power, you know, scientific power, are in today's 21st century.
Well, Americans have an incredible history of storytelling, and you talk about that too. And I just read Duncan Watt's book, Everything Is Obvious, and you know this idea that we crave these stories to basically make things that are highly complex less complex as at one end of the spectrum, but also I think on a very positive end of the spectrum, it's ways we communicate. And for some people, that's in a piece of music, and or some people poetry, and some people comedy. But I never thought about linking it actually to power. But then when you think about it, the stories that we are able to tell of ourselves, and you think about Lincoln, right? What a story.
Yeah.
What an amazing story.
Oh, my God.
And I don't know how much he crafted that for himself or he had other people chronicling, but certainly that's – and the story we have right now, Trump's an amazing story. So clearly that connection is strong.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting – Kelly, I've been teaching leaders for 20 years, you know, leaders in government and business and science and the arts and really all over the world. And I, you know, it's interesting, like one of the things that I've noticed just observationally in studying the people who are really great leaders is God, they were really humbling and artistic storytellers. And they had these amazing ways of telling the people they were leading stories about their own life in an organization. They had amazing ways of telling micro stories, right? Like, wow, you know, somebody that they're managing comes in and a relative is dying of cancer, and they would tell their own personal story of that experience. They had these stories about the organization they're part of. And what we're now learning from the science of storytelling is that, I mean, there's almost nothing more inspirational and moralizing and uplifting than hearing a story that unites people, right? And so what we take all of that wisdom and then we say, wow, this is one of the underappreciated talents that gets us influence in the world is to tell great stories.
I also thought this was interesting is you cite gossip as being basically a check and balance on power.
It is.
All right, explain that.
I know. And boy, was I popular in my middle school daughter's, you know, school.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. You've just justified all this terrible gossip.
So, you know, one of the things that we need to, when we think about power dynamics, you know, what, you know, it very obviously your attention goes to the powerful person, right? Mm-hmm. Trump or, you know, or Steve Jobs or Sheryl Sandberg or whatever the case, or, you know, Oprah.
Yep.
And we think about their magical qualities and who they are and their charisma and so forth. But it's, you know, it's back to your first question, which is we groups determine the power of individuals. We give it to them and we take it from them. Mm-hmm. And there were really fascinating studies that influenced my writing of The Power Paradox of hunter-gatherer societies about this dynamic. And what they talked about is what are called leveling mechanisms by which groups rein in the abuses of leaders and really can reduce and control that individual's power. And one of the most powerful forms of that is gossip, right? Mm-hmm. So we've found, and a variety of investigators have found, that social groups will gossip about individuals who are trying to gain power, but do so in Machiavellian mischievous ways, right? Mm-hmm. So when we're in a group, like a comedy group or a scientific community or a sorority or fraternity or what have you, we tend to gossip about these really problematic people who want power, but want to do it in a really unethical way. And studies find that if I gossip about you, it will rein in your power, your abuses of power, to make you behave more effectively, and it can also diminish your power. So I'm always put in this funny position of singing the virtues of things like teasing, which I wrote about for the New York Times, and gossip as ways to rein in abuses of power.
So interesting. It's a little bit linked, you know, because you talk a little bit about laughter and comedy, and you talk in general about like contagious laughter and shared amusement as a way of uniting individuals in the spirit of a common cause. And we all know, we all get that, you know, from a comedy sort of perspective, this is when so much of comedy is just recognizable human truth. Louis C.K. says something, we're like, I can't believe he said that. That's so honest and so true. Now, there's another kind of comedy which you use to sort of define others. That would be sort of, you know, racial jokes or gender jokes or that sort of thing. It seems those are two sides of a very similar coin, which is all about, again, the sort of check and balance, right? Can you be used positively? Can you be used negatively?
Yeah, you know, and it's so interesting, like, one of the things, I love that analysis, Kelly, and it was fitting that, you know, you've probably thought for all your life about the nature of humor and jokes, and, you know, and there are stories and jokes and forms of satire that unite and uplift, right? Mm-hmm. And you can, I bet you would have lots of examples of that kind of humor. And then there are forms of, you know, satire and jokes and humor that tear down the outgroup, that tear down the other.
Yep.
And what really strikes me is when we are rising in power, our humor and our storytelling, and we found this in various studies, tends to unite groups of people and have this uplifting quality. But then once you feel the arrogant qualities of power and being above others, your story, your jokes and your storytelling tends to demean weaker individuals. And I consider that an ethical violation, to be frank. And I think examples of that are around. So it's a really nice distinction to think about what are the social behaviors that lift up social communities without demeaning others, and then when do we go awry and demean others?
Interesting when you think about the arc of a comedian's career, because we rarely say that a comedian gets funnier as they get older, right? I mean, that this is, you know, and I've always looked at that in terms of, well, you know, once they achieve fame, they get a little lazy, which might be, you know, part of it. But those who have later success tend to be people who have sort of reinvented their comic voice. And I think in particular of two examples, Bill Murray and Steve Martin. You know, Steve Martin is not doing the same kind of comedy, the sort of stupid jokes that he started with. And you know, he became sort of an artist, craftsman.
Yep.
And Murray's the same. Murray's, you know, just a phenomenon of an individual as well as an actor who doesn't resemble his early work at all.
Wow. Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things that I thought a lot about, and it's so I wish we had data on that, Kelly, because it's a fascinating question about when you're rising on a comedy circuit, do you have this kind of humor that's sophisticated and uplifting and uniting, and then once you get the big paycheck or the special or the show, mm-hmm. you lose that edge. And I do feel that this you know, kind of this trajectory of rising in power with all the great stuff of your particular trade or discipline. And then once you have power, you lose those subtle geniuses that get you the influence in the first place. I think it characterizes a lot of artistic careers, right? So it'd be interesting to look at how comedy shifts. And the people who transcend it are the people who stay close to empathy. They really care about innovation and the evolution of a trade like comedy. And they work hard at it.
And they have to change. They have to change their game. And I think, you know, if you cross over into the other, you know, when you think about, you know, musicians, the sort of Neil Youngs of the world, who have to reinvent themselves over and over and over again as a way to stay fresh, as opposed to, you know, Billy Joel cranking out, you know, year number 25 of the you know, Piano Man.
Yeah, and I always thought, as you may know, one of my heroes is Iggy Pop, whom I adore. And, you know, I think the part of the genius of Iggy Pop is he keeps it small and he dives into the crowd and he mm-hmm. gets people up on stage to sing with him. So he, in a way, is practicing the trade of Lincoln, which is to cure others as part of your art.
I'm going to guess that this is one of the only places where we're tying together Iggy Pop and Abraham Lincoln. I think I can safely say no one has done that at least this week. So if we've accomplished nothing else, there's that. Okay, so we're taping this in the middle of March Madness, and I'm gleaning from reading your book that you're a basketball fan.
Oh my God! It is.
And of course, you know, I'm a Chicagoan, and I had, you know, six glorious years of championships here. It's not so great now, but you actually talk about a basketball study that sort of equates, you know, touching and success, I guess, would be the thing, or high fives and success and power. Yeah. How does that work?
So, you know, so the scientific story is a subtext of what we've been talking about today, which is that, you know, we are this collective hypersocial primate, and we have a lot of really old behaviors that you can trace back in mammalian evolution that unite us into strong groups. Things like laughter happens to be one, and play and mirroring and empathy, actually a lot of stuff that you teach in improvisation. And then another one, and in fact, I think perhaps one of the most fundamental is touch, right? Touch is this ancient language of connection. We have big parts of our brain that process information about touch. Your skin is 6 to 8 pounds of billions of cells that take in information about touch. And then so that's the scientific platform for the thesis that touch, the right kind of touch, makes teams strong. And then my own experience came out of playing several thousand pickup games of basketball and noticing, like, you know, I've hurt my body, I've banged into people, I've broken noses, but I've never seen aggression on the basketball court. And I came to the conclusion, you know, that this interesting institution of pickup basketball is made peaceful and collaborative through touch. So Michael Krauss, who was a fellow basketball player, and I did a study where we coded one game of every team in the NBA from, I think, the 2008 season. We coded all the touch that they did on the court with between teammates. And this is, you know, high fives, rump slaps, head knocks, chest bumps, flying hip bumps. And then we looked at how much the team touches at the start of the season predicts that they play better at the end of the season. And indeed, we find, you know, these little 1 second high fives and chest bumps and encouraging rump slaps actually make teams play better over the course of the season. And then individual players who touch their teammates more also make their teams better. So it's a singing the praises of a very subtle form of teamwork, which is touch.
I like to think I would have guessed this because I followed his career, but you sort of note that from your study that Kevin Garnett, number one,
yeah,
touch to success ratio.
Yeah, we, you know, so then we got into these funny analyses, like who are the great touchers, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting, Kevin Garnett was really our best toucher, just touching players all over the place, mm-hmm, on the court. And, you know, it's interesting, after this study came out, somebody interviewed a teammate of Kevin Garnett, and I think he was on the Celtics at the time, and we're going to go back to Abe Lincoln. I mean, the teammate spoke of Kevin Garnett as a spiritual leader,
yep,
right? Like, this guy, he keeps me, you know, right on the court.
Yep.
Now, we couldn't link that to touch, but it is part of this very ancient language of how we make for strong communities.
Yeah,
go chest bump your colleagues, Kelly.
I know. I believe me. I do it all the time. I got to see Garnett play his senior year at Farragut High School in the Chicago High School Championships. Adam McKay, the film, uh-huh, director, and I went. And I mean, an imposing presence simply in high school with his height, but also that he was a galvanizing force, and he would constantly bring in his other teammates for sort of hugs on the court, or, you know, like you
right,
just saw it play out. So that's really cool.
Wow. That is cool.
We're coming close to the end, and I'm going to ask you for your yes and story. But before we do that, I have to, again, I was talking to my wife about your book, and I read this quote to her, which she agreed with. And it's, quote, having more women in positions of leadership is likely to increase innovation and the bottom line.
Yeah,
that strikes me as true based on my, you know, 30 years in business. But what's the data say about women in positions of power in the business world and leading organizations?
Well, you know, it's so interesting, Kelly. I was talking to my daughter, who's 19, about this, you know, like what happens when women rise in power. And women are rising with respect to management positions, you know, not quite cracking the CEO glass ceiling yet, but I think that'll happen. There are more women governors, more women in the Senate than there were 50 years ago. And this is a worldwide trend. And the big question is, like, what's going to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be a little bit more empathetic and, you know, other oriented and collaborative. And my daughter said, rightfully so, like, well, you know, we don't quite have the data yet. We don't know. I mean, this is a new social human experiment. But there are recent findings. Really recent findings. One is a Credit Suisse study. When women rise in positions of management in organizations, corporations, the bottom line is enhanced. Second study is women in, as you have more women in governments, parliaments, you're less likely to see corrupt behavior in politicians. So I think there are really interesting reasons to suspect that this is part of the reason why we have less corrupt governments today than, say, 75 years ago. Steve Pinker in The Decline of Violence makes a big deal about the decline of violence being due to women becoming more prominent in culture. So I think there are a lot of reasons to, notwithstanding the American political situation, that this will be a really positive change in where we go as a culture.
Yeah, that's good news. Okay, so the podcast is called Getting to Yes and this is all around the improv principle that when you're making something out of nothing, the one way that you can do that poorly is by starting with no. That kills everything. And you can't just stop at yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I wonder if you have a story from your life or your work where you might have said no normally, but you took a shot at saying yes and you can tell us what happened.
Wow. Well, you know, I would say I got this crazy call from a fellow named Stacy Bear, who's a veteran, who said, you know, I've read about your research on awe, and I think that if we can get awe to under-resourced teens and cities and veterans who are really struggling, one of the highest suicide rates in the United States is in veterans. Would you join me in trying to do this programmatically and scientifically by studying the benefits of getting outdoors for these groups? And the first part of my mind was like, I don't work with veterans. The clinical issues are complex. You know, I'm leery of getting into that space of the military and so forth. But it has been really the most illuminating experience in my career, in some sense, is to, you know, to think about a science of awe as it applies to getting veterans out on rivers, rafting with the Sierra Club, charting the benefits, and just thinking about getting this softer science into the care of those individuals. So it really, my first instinct was to say, I run a lab, I do this lab research, right. This is weird stuff, but it's been profound.
That's a great story, and it ties into something that's been a bit of a theme through these conversations. And one of the very first podcasts that we recorded was with the Reverend Dr. Sam Wells, who is the vicar at St. Martin in the Fields, and he had written a book on ethics and improvisation that I picked up, and he wrote it like 10 years ago, but I picked it up. It was great. And during our conversation and during some of my research on him, he was saying, in his mind, the fundamental area of concern in the human condition now is isolation. And back to, you know, what we opened talking about is this idea of connectedness being so, so powerful. And right now we're building a universe with all these, you know, it's amazing. We call it networks, right? We have all these amazing networks, but many of them can serve to keep us indoors and isolate us so that we don't actually even talk to other humans, let alone go out and experience the awe of nature.
Yeah. Yeah, what a great place to end. I mean, we are this hypersocial species. Our power, as I write about the power paradox, comes from how well you manage, how you move a social network, but it has to be face-to-face.
That's great. Dacre Keltner, thank you for coming on the show.